So I know yesterday we ran out of these papers. There's two separate papers here. One is more set up, this one called Is Ethanol Controversial and Should It Be? Is some of the stuff I'll talk about, and it's more geared towards the question of the kinds of things you hear about ethanol, like do we have enough land, energy balance, questions like that. The second paper is much more of a policy question, and it's meant to be more a document for Washington than for this audience on how we might simply address the issues around ethanol. So let me get going. Feel free to grab a copy of the paper. It's really written for Washington, so keep that in mind. Sort of focused on policy. Okay. I know some people got it yesterday. It ran out yesterday, so. So I'll cover two quick things today. First is my view of biofuels. And secondly, a short presentation on the ballot initiative we have in California, now called Proposition 87, which will be on the November 7th ballot. I'll cover both those and hopefully still leave time for questions. I won't necessarily go through this presentation, even though it's a fairly long one, but it's the short version of my long presentation. The long one has 150 slides for those of you more interested in details. I will skip through much of it, so advance warning on that. Let me start with a couple of assertions. And my main point here is this is not an alternative fuel. It can be a mainstream fuel. And I don't mean we can get rid of all the gasoline. I mean we can get, this can be the majority of our fuel consumption for cars and light trucks. We can come back and talk about diesel if people are interested. We don't need to wait for hydrogen. I think many people are starting to agree with me now. A year ago, that was controversial. Most importantly, we don't need new cars, new engine designs, new distribution systems, and a very rapid changeover is possible with, and this is usually the gotcha, it costs X, Y, and Z. Hopefully I'll prove to you that it doesn't cost anything for consumers, automakers, government. And as implausible as it may seem, my hope is I'll walk you from implausible to plausible to possible to probable. And that will be the goal for today. Obviously, the not-so-magic answer, it's cheaper in Brazil, but more importantly, it's also cheaper in Denver. And I'll come back to this issue. So what makes it these implausible assertions plausible? First, Brazil's already done it. What most people don't realize is in 3 years since the first introduction of the flex fuel car, Brazil went from 4% of auto sales being flex fuel cars to 80%. And I talked to the CEO of Ford, and he said he just completely shocked him. They got pulled into the market by consumer demand, and there was no mandates or anything. VW introduced it in the first quarter of 2003 and just taken off since then. They've replaced 40% of their petroleum. In fact, when I was there in April, they declared formal independence from imported oil, not oil. Remember, Brazil, it's 15 to 20 years to turn over the car fleet, so the old cars are still around. But they're now on a path where almost all cars have to be flex fuel. give consumers the choice for the life of the car. It's not saying go to ethanol, it's saying I get a choice and I'll fill in the cheaper fuel. Production costs are dramatically lower for ethanol in Brazil compared to the U.S. and have a wide range for gasoline production costs. They can be lower than that, they can be higher than that depending upon the price of oil. In fact, when in the 10th largest car market in the world, which is Brazil, VW thinks about phasing out all gasoline-only cars, we should be paying attention. And Brazilian ethanol has a dramatic reduction in greenhouse gases with relatively old technology, I might add. You could make Brazilian ethanol four times more efficient per acre. I'll talk about that in a minute. Lots of savings. So hopefully that makes it at least plausible that we can do it. Now, what makes it possible? We've all heard statistics that certain, the fair amount of ethanol in this country and fair amount of flex fuel cars. What to me is more compelling is there's almost no distribution of flex fuel, of E85 fuel. But there's almost as many flex fuel cars on the roads of California today as there's diesel vehicles. That's a surprise to most people. Already on the road today, it's about 300 and some thousand flex fuel cars versus 400,000 diesel vehicles. That's shocking. That's how real this is. And U.S. production costs of ethanol are about $1 a gallon. And so they should be cheaper, and I'll come back to that. A rapid and 20% a year increase in capacity is a gross underestimate. Right now, it's about 50% a year increase in capacity dialed in for 06, 07, and 08 at least, and probably 09. That's the rate at which capacity is increasing. It's a low-cost switch over to manufacturers, about $35 a car to for the life next 15 years of that car. Give the consumer the choice of either putting in ethanol or put in gasoline. Or a mixture. And we can come back to that during questions. It's a complex answer. But in Brazil, people fill in the tank with gasoline, and then at some point in the future, but it tends to move in phases. When prices are cheaper one way or another, in Brazil, it depends a lot on the harvest season.
Do your prices include the subsidy or exclude the subsidy?
No, I'm talking about production costs without any subsidies or taxes.
But no correction for energy density.
No correction. I'll get to that in a minute.
Density.
So what? How do we go from possible, and hopefully you agree with me that at least that makes that data makes it possible, if not probable. What makes it probable? And I apologize, I'm moving fairly quickly. The following things have to be aligned. Interest groups have to be aligned, land use. Do we have enough land? Is the right energy balance, emissions, and kickstarting things? So interest groups, the fact is it's the first time almost all the interest groups we know of are aligned, except possibly the oil companies, though I would have to say most of them are starting to see it as a material business opportunity. They're somewhat slower to respond, and I would be too if I was making as much money as they are. But I think almost everybody is seriously investigating it. I've recently heard that even Exxon's getting serious about it, which was traditionally the laggard in this area. BP and Shell, of course, are most aggressive with this. The environment, it's not very often you get the environmental groups siding with the farm interests. That's pretty unusual. And the automakers, at least the U.S. automakers, all agree this is a good idea. So let me address the issue of land use, and I'll come back to this interest group question. The NRDC estimates, and this was a multi-year, multi-scientist study over, they took experts in four or five different areas across many years, got multiple experts in each area, came up with this assessment. This report, it's a long report, it's 100 and some pages on their website called Growing Energy. But they estimate it takes 114 million acres to meet all of our transportation needs for fuel. Jim Woolsey, who you've heard before, and George Shultz have written a paper that estimate, and I'll be more accurate, say they estimated half our needs met from 30 million acres, and I use 60 for simplicity of comparison. My own estimates, based on technology estimates of where technology is likely to go, says 40 to 60 million acres supplies all of our energy needs within 25 years. And the paper has some of my assumptions on it. The one on is ethanol controversial. It goes through details around yields of energy crops like switchgrass and acanthus by year and its progression over the next 25 years. What is likely to be the yield in 25 years? What do you get in gallons per ton of crop? So I won't go into that here, but suffice it to say there's a detailed model behind it.
Is enough water for the production?
Yes, there is enough water, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Maybe I should answer it right here. My assumption is we have between CRP land and export crop lands about 120 million acres in this country. Some fraction of that, and essentially I'm assuming in my models that export crops will be replaced by energy crops and make us not use any more land than we are using today. It also turns out that these energy crops are a perfect crop rotation crop for row-intensive crops like corn and others. So if you are a corn farmer, you should be crop rotating with these crops because they fix carbon in the air. If I might get through this quickly, and then we'll come back to questions. And that's not including other sources, and I won't talk about it. The most promising are new synthesis technologies, but some of them are so secretive today that I can't really talk about it. I might refer to one company, Synthetic Genomics, as doing something interesting. I think you saw this slide. You've seen this before. But that's a year's worth of growth. I've assumed we start with 6 tons per acre. This crop is today in experimental lot, and the University of Illinois paper is there, is yielding 15 to 20 tons per acre today. My assumption is by 2025 we'll get to 27. I expect the peak in 25 years will be more like 50 tons per acre. I might, for reality check, tell you that there is an energy crop in Brazil, which is a version of a cane called an energy cane, that's yielding 200 dry tons per hectare, which amounts to about 33 tons per acre without irrigation. And that's higher than my assumption for 2025 for energy crops. So just to give you a rational assumption of, because that's the most important assumption, what do you assume in tons of biomass per acre? Also, it turns out, and I don't have time to go into it, the farmer makes more revenue and profits per acre under this scenario than with corn or soybean or any of those intensive crops that not only make less money, but they degrade the environment. Just for fun, this is slide Senator Feinstein referred to the other day, which is, and this is hypothetical, if you turned South Dakota into just producing energy crops and assumed only 15 tons per acre, where would it rank as an oil producer? It'd be up there next to Iran. If you got to 30 tons per acre and 120 gallons per ton, which I believe we can get to by 2030, then you're talking about it being bigger than the same as Saudi Arabia in oil production per day. So let me address the question of energy balance, which is the next question after land use, which is this a material question? And Argonne National Labs has concluded that this is not even the right question to ask. The reason they cite for it is electricity. Their conclusion about energy balances, corn ethanol reduces petroleum use by about 90%, fossil fuels use by some factor like, for a unit of fossil fuel, you get 1.3 to 1.7 units of energy out, is their conclusion based on probably the most transparent model I've seen, because it's on their website, you can download it, change the assumptions, and run a new model. Which makes it very easy to compare assumptions. What's most important is gasoline isn't a unit of energy out for a unit of energy in. In fact, it's more like 0.8. surprisingly, you get 0.4 units of electricity out for a unit of energy. So if one were just looking at energy balance, one would say one should never use electricity because it's five times worse than corn ethanol. Corn ethanol has an important role to play, and let me talk about it. I think the amount of corn ethanol in this country is going to be limited to about 15 billion gallons. Nobody disagrees with that, but it's serving a very, very important purpose. It's getting the infrastructure set up, the cars on the roads, and it's getting the system primed. And it's encouraging investors to invest in cellulosic ethanol because the market exists. If the market didn't exist, you wouldn't get that investment. So all of us agree we need to go to cellulosic ethanol, but corn is a great place to start, and I think it's unfair to critique it the way I've seen it criticized, and those that I believe are just delaying tactics. The second thing I should say is corn ethanol isn't corn ethanol. It depends on how it's produced. In 1985, your laptop may have weighed 15 pounds to get a certain amount of functionality. It can weigh 2 pounds today. The best corn ethanol being produced today, corn ethanol plant coming online next month in Mead, Nebraska, $70 million project, has a better energy balance, five times the energy out than fossil energy in, using a series of technology tricks. And that's corn ethanol. That's better than projected for cellulosic ethanol initially.
That figure of five is for the plant or includes the fertilizer and everything
else? Includes everything, the whole chain, including for the Greek model. And, you know, it's interesting. What they do is build a plant near cattle head. They feed the distiller's grain without drying it, which saves half the energy cost in the plant, to the cattle. They take the manure from the cattle, put it in digesters, make methane to power the plants. They use no natural gas. And they take the remnants of the manure, turn it into fertilizer to feed their crops. So they don't use fertilizer outside. All I'm saying is you'll see corn ethanol with balances from one times energy out or less to five times or more. And cellulosic is coming along and will probably merge seamlessly into today's corn plants, gradually increasing their energy balance. The first things I've seen is biomass gasification just to replace natural gas in corn plants. And that dramatically improves the energy balance, and that's not very fancy. We know how to do that. And that's starting to happen now because natural gas is expensive. So this is what I was referring to. This is argon charts. Cellulosic ethanol is 12 times gasoline, the energy balance. I won't go through these in the interest of time. This slide set is available on my website, and if you email it to me, this is the latest set, I'll go through this. This chart is worth pointing to for a minute. This is the latest chart from the NRDC, so you can trust them with respect to energy balance. And it charts CO2 emissions for various alternative fuels. So coal is on the left, and ethanol of various varieties starts with the green. But you can see ethanol with today's technology, with old technology, ethanol with natural gas in various progressions. And again, I suggest you study it. The point I want to make is this is not your father's ethanol, and it is continuously improving as businesses try and reduce the cost of producing ethanol by using less fossil energy. Finally, you get to negative carbon emissions because many of these energy crops, like miscanthus, while putting carbon in the plant, also fix it in the soil. I mentioned it's used for crop rotation for that purpose. It actually puts carbon in the soil and improves the soil. That's how you get negative carbon emissions from using gasoline. One of the reasons I like corn ethanol is it's shown us a progressive path where we can continuously improve for the next 25 years. Any attempt to radically change the infrastructure in one big step, as hydrogen attempts to do, generally tends not to work. This is continual improvement, all for economic reasons. Gets better and better and cheaper and cheaper. And this is, again, the E3 biofuels plant that I mentioned before. That's what they're using. The way to conclude on energy balance is to use some conclusions from the NRDC report called Energy Well Spent on ethanol. And I'll let you read it. I won't read the slides. Suffice it to say, the point is, petroleum use is dramatically reduced, even with the worst corn ethanol. And if energy independence is our goal, then in fact it's a good thing, irrespective. When you add climate change as an additional target, then we will see it get better every year for the next N years. There's 13 plants in construction in California today. The majority of them don't dry their distiller's grain and have an energy balance above 2. The majority of them. I mentioned emissions. This is some charts on vehicle emissions. Suffice it to say, this is California Air Resources Board, the strictest air emissions program in the country, and compares a Ford Taurus or a Mercedes, both running on E85 and gasoline, and emissions look pretty good. What's not mentioned here is today gasoline is very much a part of benzene emissions and a known carcinogen. And if I were an oil company, I'd be worried about liability, just like there's liability from MTBE. And all that is without assuming radical technology progression. And I see all this happening. My personal bet is short-term we'll see cellulosic bioethanol the way we see it from enzymes. But the more promising technologies, even within 3 years, are gasification technologies. And then there's a great project out of MIT called Green Fuels, Green Fuel Technologies. And I'll put them on a map in a subsequent slide. But suffice it to say that they are assuming they can get maybe 50 times the amount of ethanol per acre that we assume today, 50 times. That would say, a very small piece of the cropland, maybe 10 million acres, would meet all our energy needs. Synthetic biorefineries, the kinds of projects that Craig Venner is doing with synthetic genomics, and I think there's other stuff beyond that that's very promising also, but still research. So this is the chart I was referring to on what can we get in the end in gallons per acre of ethanol. Today, we are on the left, corn ethanol and sugarcane today. It's about 400, 500 gallons per acre. My optimism comes from the fact that the Brazil energy cane is already showing numbers around 2,500 to 3,000 gallons per acre, and they expect to bring these online. But this is a private company. This data is not publicly available, but all the details aren't. But I visited, these are sort of a multi-year research effort, venture capital funded in Brazil, hidden away, no U.S. venture capital firm involved. In fact, it's funded by the largest industrial family in Brazil. So they've had a lot of money for a long time to take a long-term view of this. And it's very promising. At 27 tons per acre, and 108 gallons per ton, you start to see numbers like 3,000. At 3,000, we need very little land. Now, the 108 gallons per ton is stuff that I believe is achievable in the near term, in the next 2 years or 3 years, with gasification technologies, not the enzymatic technologies that people are talking about. How do we get from here to there? I'm going to move on from why I believe in biofuels and how you go from implausible assertions to possible, and hopefully I've convinced you possible ways to get there, to what we need to do in policy. So the next phase is about policy, and I believe we need three simple things to happen in Washington, none of them. And remember, I started with the assertion it takes no money from consumers. Hopefully, I've proven to you that this fuel will be cheaper than gasoline. It takes no money or very little money from the automakers because it's a huge marketing benefit, and that's why GM is starting to market it, to say you get a car that can run either fuel for the next 15 years of its life. Now, what do we need from Washington, and why I think it takes no money from Washington either? First, we should require that 70% of new cars be flex fuel cars in this country. It would give U.S. automakers a huge advantage. They're the only ones producing flex fuel cars in the U.S. They dominate the market in Brazil. Toyota and Honda are essentially absent from the flex fuel market in Brazil and hence have almost no market share in Brazil. This is good for U.S. automakers, and we should mandate that 70% of those new cars. Now, if somebody asks me why 70%, I can get to it. There's a complex set of reasons I picked that 70% number. We should require that 10% of the gas stations in this country offer E85 right away. Now, that's 10% of the gas stations would be some small number of pumps because each gas station has multiple pumps. For comparison, Sweden has mandated that 60% of its gas stations by 2009 offer pumps. So this is a very modest requirement compared to the 60% that Sweden has mandated. And finally, this is one of my favorites. There's this so-called subsidy on ethanol, a 51 cent a gallon credit that you get as a producer. Two facts to know about it. Because of a one-word change that was affected in the legislation well after midnight when it was being negotiated in committee, the word was changed from producer's credit to a blender's credit. Almost 100% of the subsidy today is collected by the oil companies. Okay, not two, there's also a 54 cent a gallon tax on importing ethanol. So the constraint we impose in this country is the cheapest gasoline in the world from Saudi Arabia competes with the most expensive ethanol in the world produced in the Midwest from the most expensive source, corn. And that's an unfair constraint. We should be importing this tariff-free. And it's unfair, but that's the way it is. But having said that, in realizing that political realities are as they are, I am suggesting that we reduce the subsidy today and make it variable. So it's 51 cents no matter what the price of oil is. I'm suggesting it be 20 cents at 70 cents a gallon, $70 a barrel of oil. If oil drops to $30 a barrel, the subsidy be increased to 80. With EIA forecast, the Energy Information Administration, we would never reach 30. The subsidy would go down. Farmers would get insurance. Ethanol producers would get free insurance. And we'd be spending less money on subsidies. Not only that, I'll come back to one other modification I'm proposing in Washington. This has a huge impact of reduced subsidies and increased value to ethanol producers in the form of insurance in case the price of oil is manipulated. If you look to Cambridge Energy Research Associates, they will tell you that in 1973, after the oil shock, the U.S. economy econometrically got decoupled from oil. By the early 80s, there was very little correlation in the economic growth model between economic growth and oil price. Saudi Arabia explicitly decided to drop the price of oil to recouple the economy. Their goal was to get us addicted to oil explicitly, and this is not my conjecture, this is a Cambridge Energy Research Associates report. They did recouple, they dropped oil to $8 a barrel, and guess what, we have an oil addiction. They attempted to do something 20 years ago. They achieved it. That's why we are where we are. Now, can that happen again? Absolutely. Did Enron manipulate the price of energy? Absolutely. So this is a signal to Saudi Arabia and the national oil companies. And I will tell you, the vice chairman of a major national oil company came to me at Davos and said, if you are successful after I made this presentation, we can drop the price of oil. That was direct to my face. I was completely galled. And that's why I'm proposing we reduce the subsidy in a clever way that provides countercyclical insurance if they manipulate the price of oil. My belief is if you signal to them you're serious about countering the price of oil by a counter-cyclical subsidy, they will not even attempt to manipulate the price. And so we'll be with energy prices where, or oil prices where they should be based on market condition. Not that OPEC is a free market. It's a cartel by definition. So all these three things which take no government money achieve the following goal. They tell investors the cars will be there, the distribution will be there, we won't let Saudi Arabia manipulate the price of oil, and if you can produce ethanol cheaper than gasoline, then go at it. We are serious about leveling the playing field. That's what these three things do. They don't take money, and if we achieve these, then we are home free. If I might come back to questions later. So let me switch at this point to what we are doing in California. I promised to cover both items and then leave some time for questions. Remember in my slides I said we need to address the interest groups. We agree it's good for farmers, it's good for auto producers, it's good for environmentalists, and I think it'll be good for oil companies because it's a major new business opportunity. We addressed the land use question, the energy balance question, the emissions question, and our last bullet was kickstarting. I believe the main thing we need to do is kickstart this alternative oil replacement economy. And that's why we have a proposition on the California ballot not qualified as Proposition 87, the California Clean Energy Alternative Energy Act, that will be voted on by California voters on November 7th. Now let me say this is a California ballot initiative, but it has important implications nationally. I believe if we kickstart it in one place and achieve critical mass, it will roll through the rest of the country and the rest of the world. And that's why I'm spending a fair amount of my time on it, and there's a whole group of people, and I am a Johnny-come-lately to this. Other people initiated this effort. I didn't. But a whole group of people are involved. The NRDC is a very big part of this effort, as is a couple of people out of Southern California. So I thought it was so compelling that I signed on to help, and I encourage all of you to help and join the effort. So the opportunity for this came from the fact that California is the only major oil-producing state without a material oil extraction fee. Most places, most businesses, have a royalty fee when you take a resource. Even farmers in California pay for an acre foot of water. The harvesters pay for a board foot of timber if they take it from California lands. Every other state, every other major oil-producing state in this country, every other state, including Texas, charges a royalty fee. The feds, 12 miles offshore from California, charge 12% royalty to extract oil from federal waters. 11 miles offshore from California waters, we charge nothing, zero. And that argument is a very important reason we thought this was an opportunity to create a fund in being friendly to the oil companies. And again, my goal as a free market person is not to have unfair fees. We limited it to 10 years or $4 billion, whichever comes first. Believe me, my other friends wanted it to be a perpetual and higher fee. I said, well, let's do the minimum we need to intervene, kickstart this alternative, and then get out of the way. This disappears in 10 years or $4 billion. And at today's oil prices, it'll be only 6 years, is our estimate. So all other states charge a fee, Alaska, Louisiana, even Texas, the most oil-friendly state, except us. But because of lobbying, we don't think we can get it through the assembly. We consulted with enough people to see if we could pass it as legislation. We were laughed at. And, you know, I don't need to say much about the amount of money that goes into lobbying. The next question is this an unfair burden? And I'll get to why this makes sense, because the reason isn't the oil companies are an easy target and we should take their money. The reason is there's some valuable things we can do. But we want to make sure it's fair. It's not a huge fee on the oil companies. It doesn't affect their profitability. As the price of oil has gone from $28 in February of 2004, you see that little mark there? All of that extra money has been free money for the oil companies because the oil prices increase. Without paying a royalty on a California natural resource that they're depleting. So that's the reason this makes sense. And this data is from the UC Berkeley group. So why this fee? Which is the main reason? It's, like I said, a 10-year, $4 billion fine. $2.3 billion of that will be used for gasoline and diesel use reduction. No matter what the technology, if you can achieve that goal, you can get money for it. $1.1 billion will go to research and innovation in clean technologies for California universities. It's the university system which will benefit. Energy R&D in the universities has actually been declining over the last 30 years, and this is a way to rejuvenate it. There's some other sources. We think we can achieve a 25% reduction from today's oil consumption in California, but I'm much more interested in the global implications of this. This is really, in my mind, something that will have global repercussions. When you have these alternative technologies show up, they will be used in New York and Iowa and Sweden and India and China. This will start a whole new cycle of new innovation. The initiative itself is technology neutral. It's not about ethanol. I talked about that today as one possible solution. There's others. Plug-in hybrids, you've heard a lot about. Hybrids, biodiesel, all sorts of new approaches. And this initiative is about quick kick-starting these alternatives, as I've already said. It can be in the form of flex fuel vehicles, plug-in hybrid charging stations, low-cost loans to people who set up new facilities, new battery facilities, incentives to consumers. One important thing, being a free marketeer, the phrase at the bottom, anything, any money that's spent should be spent in technologies that scale to unsubsidized market competitiveness. It goes on to say within 7 years. That phrase appears five times in the initiative language because I insisted that we not fund technologies that can't achieve critical mass on their own once they're kickstarted. Hence, a limited period, limited dollars, limited time for each technology to prove it's viable. Even solar wouldn't qualify here because it's taken more than 7 years to be competitive. I won't talk about the Research and Innovation Fund, that's obvious. UC Berkeley did an economic analysis saying it would create tens of thousands of new jobs in California. The oil companies like to say it'll reduce jobs. There is an existing agency, so there will be no new bureaucracy. An existing agency that was created in 1980 that will be chartered with running this program. And it will have a diverse, balanced, independent board. The chair of the California Energy Commission, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the state treasurer, plus experts in these six areas. A balanced, business-oriented group of people who will make decisions on whether a program that's applying for funding can meet the criteria. What are the criteria again? Principal criteria is gasoline use reduction. So any creative way you can come up to do that, whether it's through efficiency improvements or new fuels, go at it. Obviously, the voters love this. I'll let you read these. Of course, most of our opponents are big oil. Our opponents are Californians against higher taxes, almost all the money coming from the Western States Petroleum Association, spearheading the effort. Those are the contributors. The numbers have increased dramatically. Shell, Exxon, others contributed about $3 million, about three each, to campaign against us.
So what do they say?
What is their campaign as far as I can tell? First, the tax will be paid by consumers. Not true. This is lying to their teeth. There was a Supreme Court case in Alabama where Alabama instituted a fee that couldn't be passed on to consumers. Exxon challenged it, went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court refused to overturn the Alabama legislation. We mirrored that language. This cannot be passed on to consumers. More importantly, it cannot be passed on to consumers because the price of oil in world markets determines the price of gasoline in California, not the extraction cost in California. Market forces will ensure that that doesn't happen. Besides, a lot of California oil has high sulfur content, not appropriate for California. But it doesn't prevent the oil companies using vast amounts of advertising dollars to tell the world otherwise. Unfortunately, there is no way for us to enforce the truth. In fact, if oil could pass their assessment costs along to consumers, why would they spend millions opposing it? And apologies to my friends from AIS Chevron. I know there's some in the room. The second piece is costly new bureaucracy. Not true. I've already talked about it. They are working on alternative energy, but not very quickly. 300,000 flex fuel cars in California, one publicly accessible pump for E85. And there's a quote from the ExxonMobil CEO. They say, if we have a royalty fee, which they call a tax, because consumers don't like taxes, they don't call it a royalty fee, it will hurt property tax revenue. The fact is, this ballot initiative generates money for California schools. Property values were frozen and mandated at very, very low levels under Prop 13 in California many, many years ago. The amount of property taxes being paid today are so far below market values because of Proposition 13, which was passed by California voters in the 80s. But this is not even a fair argument. But again, nothing prevents us from prevents them from propagating these myths. Anyway, let me stop there and open it up to questions. Yes.
I got two that I'd like you to comment on.
And feel free to question in either presentation.
You can recognize that I'm representative of the big bad major oil companies. In fact, ExxonMobil, to be specific, although I'm retired.
I'd love your help in this initiative.
I'm biased. But the two areas I'd like you to comment. First of all, you talked about the mandate for 10% of ethanol all across the country. And I'd like you to comment about the logistics, the infrastructure that's necessary to accomplish that. Because one of the biggest problems that we've run into is when you have a multiplicity of fuels, that the ability then to simultaneously distribute all the different fuels is very difficult. And ethanol is not particularly compatible in transportation with some of the other fuels. And so when you have 10% that's trying to distribute, it makes it very difficult. So I'd like you to talk about what kind of research.
So let me talk about those real quickly.
That's one thing. And then the other one is...
If I might answer that, and then we'll go to the second question, because I know other people have questions too. Let me answer it quite quickly. First, Brazil is using most of the same infrastructure. You know, this is a fallacy. If you're talking about converting 10% of the stations, it's a relatively easy task. Not every gas tank or tanker truck can be converted, but many can.
I'm not talking about...
Let me suggest the following. If you build a model, as I have, and I'll be happy to send it to you, say we're adding 1 million new flex fuel cars in 2006. If you build a mandate and say they have to be 70% by 2000...
That's not the question I'm asking you. Today, we have to... use ethanol, just to a limited, more limited extent, in gasoline in many parts of the country. Hmm. What we're finding is the only way you can distribute ethanol today is in trucks or rail cars.
Absolutely.
And when you start talking about the volume of ethanol that would be behind this, I'm not talking about the production, I'm not talking about the consumption, but I'm talking about taking the ethanol from wherever you're producing it and getting it distributed throughout the
country. So let me, that's a question I was answering. I'm saying the infrastructure enough exists to get us started. We will build it gradually. One of the myths is ethanol can't be pipelined. In fact, it is and can be pipelined.
Absolutely.
And we will build a pipeline from various places. We will produce ethanol in a distributed way. So,
but I'm in the
like pipeline. I said, there's 13 plants in construction in California.
Right. I'm in the pipeline business today, mm-hmm. and I'm living with this. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not trying to say that any of this can't be done. Technically, there's no problem with doing it. But the cost, the investment that's going to be required to accomplish that is very significant. And if you isolate a market, and if you have a way to, even if you went to 100% in a particular market, that's a lot easier to do than to have a 10% distribution across the country. So, but anyway, that's
so I'll be happy to send you a model that actually has the level of investment required per year for the next 25 years.
Okay.
I have estimates of that. I'll be happy to share it with you.
I live with this every day. But okay, the other question I wanted to ask you is with regard to taxing, the extraction tax on production in California.
Extraction royalty fee.
Yeah. And I understand all of what you're saying, and all the other states do. But if we're, on the one hand, if we're trying to achieve energy or oil independence, California, inland production in California, California production is declining currently, and it's been declining for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
It's very expensive production, and it's going down naturally because it's being produced, and it's difficult to extract between San Joaquin Valley and so forth. Problem, California is increasingly importing crude in order to feed its refineries. So if you go ahead and you further raise the cost through a royalty of indigenous production, what you're going to do is you're going to substitute imported oil for that, which seems to me to be going the wrong direction. It seems to me that as a nation, to the extent that we need any oil, I mean, we can have the objective of reducing our oil demand.
So in the interest of time, let me be quick. I want to keep the question short, if I might.
To the extent that we need oil, the residual oil, would seem that we would want to produce our indigenous oil, not import the oil. So how does...
You know, my view is we can produce ethanol faster and replace gasoline and oil imports with ethanol faster than we can, than the oil production will come down. It is almost certainly, many of the oil wells at today's prices are being uncapped. They're being capped when prices were low. They are being uncapped because you saw the profit margins. So this is a qualitative argument. You can't win one way or another, but there's 13 new plants being planned in California that will replace.
I'm not challenging that.
Yeah, okay.
But if you raise the cost of the production, the exist at any level, wherever it is, if you just...
Today the profitability is so high, that's not true. In my belief, not true. So we can... Steve, you had a question.
So three comments, one science, one engineering, and one policy. The science comment is your very aggressive yield numbers for biomass. You know, plants suck CO2 out of the atmosphere to fix the carbon. There is a physical limit as to how fast that can happen, set by diffusion lengths mm-hmm. and cross sections and so on. Remarkably, in the tropics, production is within a factor of two of that limit. And mm-hmm. so I'd be a little cautious in extrapolating mm-hmm. too far aggressively in yields. It's not an issue currently. Second,
I might only to answer that question. You might consult with Professor Chris Somerville at Stanford.
I talk a lot.
Chris has given me the what he believes is the right limits to use.
Okay. Second, gasification. I would not be as enthusiastic about gasification of biomass. It requires larger plants. They're more expensive, and so you have transport costs to feed the plants. And the gasification of biomass is technically much more difficult than the gasification of coal.
Without going into the technologies, suffice it to say that we've seen technologies that are economic at 500 tons per day, which is very, very small. Okay? So the old assumptions are no longer true. If some of these alternatives, I would say there's at least two and probably four such efforts.
Okay.
that achieve smaller size, critical mass, economic, ethnol.
Okay. So. We can talk about that.
Yes.
The third is.
Oh, I'm sorry.
On the policy side, you know, flex fuels, mandating flex fuel vehicles and the ethanol distribution infrastructure is, of course, not technology neutral. It's banking on ethanol. As we discussed yesterday, on a 10 to 15 year timescale, which is the time it's going to take to get to 10% ethanol in the blend, there will probably be other hydrocarbon molecules that are compatible with the existing infrastructure. So you may want to think twice about betting on ethanol.
So I would agree with Steve. There are better molecules, and BP has announced butanol. I completely agree that it's a very promising molecule, and there's others, and Steve and I agree on this. We should have cars that meet the requirements of the molecules we can foresee. Now, remember, we have credits for hybrid cars, so we are already in the business of unleveling the playing field. Right? The point I'm making is the cost difference of $35 is so little.
Oh, the flex fuel, yeah.
For to make a flex fuel car, and you're not talking about engineering whole new types of cars. Remember, hybrid is a major change in the drivetrain and the way a car is managed.
Right.
And I'm a fan of hybrids too, don't get me wrong. I think anything to reduce our energy consumption. That this is such a small cost, $35 per car, to give consumers choice for the next 15 years life of the car, that it's well worth doing.
But then you have the additional difficulties with the distribution and transport infrastructure that we were talking about. So it's not just the $35 a car.
Well, I believe it will evolve gradually. It has evolved gradually. Brazil is a good model where it has evolved every year, and level of investment has gone up. And as I pointed out, my goal is to signal to Wall Street to start making those investments. If, in fact, it's economic, they'll make those investments. I'm not saying the Feds should make that investment. If it's economic, every year they'll make that choice, and that's your argument too. Will they build a pipeline? I don't know. I do know Fagan was out in Stockton looking at major new rail facilities that they're planning on building. They're going to build a major new terminal there. At least they're planning one. Now, these decisions will be made independently by investors, and that's what we want to have. All we want to do is signal the fact that we want an end to our oil addiction, and we won't allow manipulation. I believe flex fuel cars will allow for not only gasoline and ethanol, but also butanol and many other chemistries we can think of, the ones we've both seen. I wish they could even run hydrogen in internal combustion engines. I would sort of really give us the most choice we can. In fact, if hydrogen's ever going to happen, it'll, I suspect, happen in internal combustion engines first. Have that used to pull in the infrastructure for distribution and building, and then go on from there. I can't make all the choices, but we can't stay totally neutral. We have to do something about our oil addiction. And I address this issue of how this relates to free markets in my paper, because I'm very much a free marketeer. I mean, if you add in the subsidies for oil, the $50 billion a year we spend on defending our sea lanes, and General Powell can speak to it, for oil transport, and allocate a percentage of that to oil or most of it to oil, you start to look at the subsidies that already exist in the system. The fact that oil isn't a free market by the definition of OPEC as a cartel. So we are making choices, and we have to make choices. Yes, David, and then yourself.
Yes, two questions. First, the focus of this country with ethanol is mostly on corn. If we had no sugar tariff, right now it's one of the highest sugar tariffs in the world, could we use sugar in this country? Secondly, Malaysia is now developing this similar business, but using palm oil, not corn or sugar. How is palm oil compared to other raw materials?
So let me answer a couple of questions broader than the question you asked, because I think it's important. Palm oil is mostly used for biodiesel. My problem, I like biodiesel, I think it's good. I've seen how ethanol scales from 400 gallons per acre to 3,000 gallons per acre. and addresses both the environmental and land use issues. I don't see how biodiesel, whether it's from palm oil or soybean or others, scales to much above 600 gallons per acre or 800 gallons per acre. I haven't seen that long-term scaling, and I'm making a technology judgment on what technology is likely to go further, not only where they are today. Palm oil specifically is something the environmentalists oppose because of the way it's farmed in Malaysia. And so you not only have to look at just the crop, but what environmental impacts it has. And palm oil has fairly negative connotations in the sourcing of the raw feedstock. So this, what can you eventually get to in gallons per acre is an important number. I haven't seen it discussed at all in the literature at all. So I've tried to bring it to the fore as a discussion point, and one has to project where technology is likely to go with it.
I think the current numbers, about, I showed it yesterday, I think it's about 500 gallons an acre.
Yeah, right. It's between 400 and 600.
Is the problem.
But more importantly, do we see ways where it could scale to 2, 3, 4, 6 times that? The second thing I might say, and you know, it's something I'm proposing that I didn't go into in policy, I suggested we make this subsidy variable. But it's interesting that the total corn ethanol market in this country roughly matches what you could use over the next 10 years for blending with oil. If you assume 10% ethanol blends in oil, it's about 15 billion gallons, which is the maximum corn capacity. So I am suggesting we actually increase the RFS for ethanol, reserve it for corn, and get those guys off our back with all their political influence, and this is just being pragmatic, say, you can have the blending market exclusively reserved for corn ethanol with its protections, and let's remove the tariff and allow imports of free ethanol from the cheapest source in the world to compete with the cheapest oil in the world, which we do, and use it for E85. It's also environmentally much better, more free market, and more competitive, and cheaper for consumers. So the landed cost would still be below $1 a gallon. Cost. Yes, you had a question.
I actually have three quick questions. One, who's building the plant?
So this will be the last set of questions, and then we'll finish up.
Okay, just minor, real short. Who's the company that's building the plant in Nebraska that you talked
about? E3 Biofuels. E3 Biofuels.
Okay. And then the other question was...
look him up on the web. It's very impressive.
Okay. And when you talk about the insurance, that would be, if you drop the subsidy and there would be an insurance...
Well, insurance would come from the fact that it would become a counter-cyclical subsidy. I would like to remove it. I don't believe we can remove it. So I'm saying let's make it variable. Have it be 20 cents at $70 oil and 80 cents at $30 oil.
Right, but who would actually pay for that insurance?
Well, the government is already offering that credit today. I'm saying today it's 51 cents. Let's make it variable, not fixed.
Okay, and the third question is, what do you specifically do in terms of the business world? I know you're...
I'm in the venture capital business, investing in all these new technologies. So my life is about tracking the latest new technologies to produce not only ethanol, but all sorts of fuels. Thank you all. Last question.
Great for question. The amount of funding budgets for and against this proposition for another?
We are obviously trying to raise money. We don't know how much we will raise. I will tell you the oil companies will spend lots. They haven't shared their budget with me, but I expect it will be $40 million or more.
And do you think you'll be able to raise $40 million?
We are trying.
Where are you now?
We are at about 10 committed, yes. And so anybody who has any ideas for how we might raise funds, please do call me. Also, there are copies of the two papers. One, again, for those of you who came in late, one paper is on why ethanol is controversial and if it should be controversial. The second is the policy paper. Thank you all very much for coming.